Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with return guest and all-around superhero, urban warfare expert, Andrew Fox. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. And thanks to my incredibly generous mom, Lenny Meyerson, for being the founding sponsor of my show. When retired Major Andrew Fox decided to become an expert and a scholar on urban warfare, his goal was to study war strategy and its implications. Never did he expect to become one of the most beloved heroes of Israel and the world Jewish community. Not because he took sides in the Israel-Hamas war, but because he saw the bright line between good and evil, and he simply sided with good. So very much has happened since Andrew last graced this podcast with his presence, including, among many things, the international publication of his groundbreaking report, Questionable Counting, Analyzing the Death Toll from the Hamas-run Ministry of Health in Gaza, as well as a long-awaited ceasefire and hostage deal. All of this capped off by a broad and relentless disinformation campaign against the Jewish state. If you think that Hamas are freedom fighters and the Ministry of Health is some sort of ministry of truth, you owe it to yourself to listen to this discussion about what really happened in the last 15 months in Gaza and how so many people in the West have been deeply deceived by Hamas terrorist propaganda. Andrew Fox served for 16 years in the British Army, leaving as a major in the parachute regiment. He deployed on three tours in Afghanistan, including one attached to U.S. Army Special Forces, and then became a senior lecturer in the War Studies and Behavioral Sciences departments at the Sandhurst, the UK equivalent of West Point. He's currently a research fellow at the Henry Jackson Society, a Westminster political think tank, and was recently named by the Algemeiner as one of the top 100 people positively influencing Jewish life in 2024. Andrew, thank you so much for not just joining me again on the show, but also for all your important and tireless work on behalf of truth and morality.
No, thank you for having me on again. I'm glad I earned a repeat invitation.
It's an open invitation, believe me. If you want to join every day, I'm just here waiting. So let's get right into it. In December 2024, you published a groundbreaking report. Again, this was about the questionable accounting, analyzing the death toll from the Hamas-run Ministry of Health in Gaza, wherein you summarily debunked the official civilian casualty figures that basically the entire world has been recklessly using to assess the war in Gaza. Andrew, what compelled you to really dedicate the better part of a year to this painstaking statistical analysis? And can you explain to our viewers the methodology of your study?
Sure. So the reason why we did it was because from the start of the conflict, it's been clear that there's been something very fishy going on in international reporting. We understand that when an airstrike happens, there's supposed to be a, you know, an immediate count of people who've been killed, which is simply just not possible. You know, I've been in war zones where I've called for airstrikes myself, and I know that you can't immediately within minutes of the airstrike say how many people have died in it. It just doesn't work like that. So the fact that there was this running ticker tape death toll coming out, so it certainly set the old radar off. And then I was lucky enough to have conversations with a number of other researchers, and we put our heads together and we came up with this. And in terms of methodology, really the only thing we used was Hamas's figures themselves. We tried very, very hard to stick to that primary source and nothing else. And the first proviso that comes with it, we've got no way of disproving whatever total they put on it. You know, the only way to do that is to go in and count the bodies. And of course, over 15 months, that's now impossible. And as an aside, you know that some tame NGO is going to come into Gaza in the next months and weeks and verify everything they've pushed out. That's a given. But that's not going to be something that's possible to do fairly and honestly. So whichever NGO does decide to do that, their credibility is going to be pretty low stock at that point. But we looked at the names and we just tried to work out what comparisons or differences we could find between the two. And, you know, how we could cross-reference that against potentially social media, against potentially some other source of information. And those that's what led us to our findings. We broke it down into a bunch of chapters and went through it you know, issue by issue until we'd revealed all the flaws that we could find with the information available to us over open source media.
Yeah, it's amazing that we live in such a post-factual society that no one could take, say, a statistic from Israel or even the United States as a given. They would really rather listen to Hamas. So using their own words, I guess, just goes right into, okay, you want to know what Hamas has to say about this? Here you go. So that being said, why don't you give a brief overview of the key findings of your report? And I'm also very curious, like, not counting the trolls and the bots, okay, we're going to try to like get rid of those from the equation. Have you received pushback, formal pushback on your conclusion?
Yeah, for sure. Nobody's debunked sort of 4 out of 5 findings. The first finding that people don't like is the fact that we found some mistakes. And then the main criticism seems to be that we didn't find very many. Now, bearing in mind, Hamas is well known and well documented habits of concealing fighter deaths and of manipulating this data. We've, you know, we've gone back through previous conflicts and we found them a pattern of them doing this. I would suggest that with the information available to us, the odds that we found the only few hundred mistakes in the Hamas lists, I think, is extremely unlikely, I would suggest. What we were able to pick out was trends of ages being lowered and men being listed as women, Hamas people that have been killed by Hamas themselves ending up on the list, cancer patients listed for leaving on the lists. And really the key point from that chapter, I think, is that it doesn't matter how you look at it. These lists just aren't reliable. If someone didn't have an age, they were listed as 0 and therefore a child. Now, that's an easy, we can call it, be generous and say it's a mistake. But the key point here is it doesn't matter if it's a mistake or if it's deliberate. It's still not something you can rely on as gospel truth. And really interestingly, another report's come out since I was in The Lancet where they claim that Hamas has underestimated the numbers. But even they agree that those lists are unreliable, which is the critical point here. And yet the world's media has platformed them for 15 months and barely spoken about Israel, which was another finding. Our partners, 50 Global, did the media analysis where they looked at 6 major international news outlets over a 4-month period in 2024. And they worked out that the percentage of the world's media using Hamas's figures was way in the high 90%. It was like 98%, something like that. And when we look at that 98% figure, 20% of those news outlets presented the figures as if they were gospel truth. The number didn't distinguish with the fact that there are Hamas fighters in that number of that total number. And fewer than sort of 5% were using Israel's figures, completely ignoring them. And so they've effectively platformed one combatant over the other in this conflict, which is pretty unethical in my view.
Well, it's not one combatant over another. We're talking about terrorist combatants over a viable state. I mean, I could argue, if you want to make that argument, that, okay, well, the media took, you know, 100% U.S. statistics when talking about the war on terror, never asked ISIS or, you know, Al-Qaeda. I don't think that necessarily choosing one side over the other is the problem. But the fact that they decided to side with the terrorists is a frightening revelation. I mean, I can't think of an instance in like U.S. warfare where the media is like, well, you know, not this is not in words, this is what the terrorists say, but so, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, statistics prove that, you know, X number of people were killed in this airstrike. Like, it's just not done.
Yeah, and actually, you've touched on a point that's really important here, is that we couldn't tell you how many civilians we killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, the estimates you'll find on the internet vary by the tens of thousands, between which source you're asking. There is no accurate death count. Likewise, we only know how many people we've lost. We don't know how many enemy combatants we killed, never mind civilians. So it's a really important point here that a different standard is being applied to this war than in any other war that's reported on in the last 20 years. But the number of combatants that have died is important. And we went some way, I think, to proving the 17,000 that the IDF are claiming. And actually this week they've upped that estimate to 20,000. And part of the reason that I think that they're kind of vague about the number they've killed and they give a round figure like that is because it's really hard as a soldier to know how many people you've killed in any one given combat. And the IDF do exactly as Western armies do, as the US Army, as the British Army. After engagements, they'll have debriefs with their teams. They'll try and come up to estimates of how many people were shot in that particular engagement. But it's really, really tricky to do. I mean, I've had firefights in Afghanistan where at the end of it, my section commanders and I were in disagreement about the direction of the enemy, never mind how many of them they were. You know, it's chaotic. It's scary. Oh. It's, you know, it's a situation where you can't stand there with a chart and just mark off people as they go down. So, you know, the 20,000, I think we've done a very good job of proving that. We actually did some statistical modeling and we worked out it's probably about 22,500, but we didn't include that in the report because there were assumptions that we weren't comfortable with when it comes to statistical modeling that I didn't think were academically viable, although the Lancet did. The Lancet were happy to publish a report based entirely on those methods, but we didn't think it was a good thing to do. The really key stat, and I think the most important stat that we found, apart from the fact this whole Hamas have been reliable in previous conflicts piece, we managed to debunk that thoroughly, as I mentioned. The most important stat was looking at the deaths by gender and proportion. And the killer thing here is this 70% women and children figure that's been bandied around. Now, that doesn't take into account the fact that the adult male population of Gaza before the war was only 26% of the total. And when you start looking at deaths by proportion, it's well into the 50% for adult fighting age male between the ages of 15 and 45. And given that we know Hamas uses child fighters, all of a sudden they become plausibly targets. Now, you could make the argument that men always die the most in war zones, but this, when you take it into account with what we know about Israeli targeting, what we know about Israeli intelligence, and I've been there and I've witnessed that firsthand, so I can report firsthand evidence of having seen this stuff, but I think it firmly suggests that if 26% of the population were male and yet over 50% of the dead by proportion are also male, then that shows that there's some targeting going on. And this has been verified, not verified, but certainly supported by the evidence that comes out from Gaza in the last week, where we're seeing reports of dead bodies being pulled out of rubble, and they're all fighting age men. Hamas have released statistics about the number of orphan children and who've lost one parent or the other. And it's a very clear dominating ratio in favor of men to women. And so all the circumstantial evidence here is now pointing towards the fact that it's a targeted military operation and not a genocide. And I think that was probably the most important finding we made. And it was supported by that Lancet article when they were reporting on the demographics before they went into their statistical fantasy land. But for that part of it, they did support our findings, even though it was an anti-Israel paper. So I'm feeling pretty, pretty good. And so the criticisms mainly have been that we didn't find enough mistakes, which, you know, fine. We obviously stumbled across the only 100 that are in there. You know, yes. I don't think that's true.
I think that also issues like the Ministry of Health, like this is the Ministry of Health for all of Gaza. And again, I hate even saying Ministry of Health because it sounds so viable, but they are keeping statistics on like just who died in Gaza by car accident, by lung cancer, by misfired Hamas rockets, by, you know, bar fights, by, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I believe that came out to about 5,000 or 6,000 right there. And to say that, you know, this person who, you know, died of chronic heart failure is because of Israel, there's a problem there. So even if in going line by line through these reams of statistics, you know, you found X number of discrepancies, I mean, even just those like broader, just really abuse of the system to fold in deaths have nothing to do with the war as being civilian casualties.
Yeah, and the really key takeaway here is that actually, when you try and people try and tell you how many men and women have died, they can't say that looking at these lists with any certainty because of the number of errors that we found. And I think that's as straightforward as it is. And the crime is that the world's media has platformed these figures as a reliable source, and has disregarded the figures of a partner allied country that is the only democracy in the Middle East. It's absolutely insane, but it builds on decades of propaganda that Hamas have done, and they've laid their groundwork for this very well indeed.
And by no coincidence, it also happens to be the only Jewish state. We'll leave that for another day, or at least okay. So before I ask this next question, and it goes back to what you just touched upon, I do want to reiterate to viewers a point that's been made many, many times before, but there is no war beyond the Arab-Israeli conflict that is ever measured in civilian casualties. This is a standard, one of many double standards that was created just for dealing with wars that involve Israel. However, can you explain the significance of the essentially one-to-one ratio of civilian to Hamas casualties in this current war?
Well, it's really indicative of the civilian care that's been taken by the IDF. I'm very wary of the ratio that's so trumpeted, because it doesn't matter if you kill 10 civilians to one combatant, if you killed all 10 legally. Likewise, you could kill one to one, and if you killed the one illegally, then that's a terrible thing. So we have to be slightly careful of the ratio. It's not how many died, it's how. But I think that low ratio is a good indicator, because it's supported by other indicators. We know how many people have been displaced in Gaza. Now, on the surface, that's a terrible thing, but the alternative to displacing people to protect them from battles that are about to start is leaving them there when the battle kicks off. And you'd have vastly higher numbers of civilian dead were that the case. And I've spoken to the people in the IDF who fought in Gaza, and they tell me that they've fought in ghost towns because people have listened to evacuation orders and they have bugged out. So that one-to-one ratio is impressive in the sense that I think it points towards civilian care. And then we have to look around what else has happened, and we can say, yeah, actually, there's enough circumstantial evidence out there to suggest that this is correct.
Sure. And if people really want to try to like push this argument that Israel is deliberately targeting civilians, then how can anybody reconcile that Gaza has suffered approximately 85% physical destruction of its structures and yet 2-3% of its population? Mm-hmm. Those numbers do not line up in any possible scenario.
No, and Palestinian media was reporting yesterday that the IDF have dropped over 100,000 tons of munitions on Gaza, which is clearly the reason for a lot of the destruction. But actually, they've only killed 45,000 people, of which around half are Hamas fighters, of a population of 2.1 million. That works out to over 2 tons of explosive for every fatality. And now there's two things, there's two options here. Either the Israeli Air Force are the worst shots in the history of warfare, and I'm not exaggerating there, or there weren't that many people around when the bombs were dropping. And again, that once again supports the idea that Israel has taken huge amounts of care with civilian lives by evacuating them, by sending millions of text messages, phone calls, and dropping leaflets to make sure people aren't in the areas when these bombs are dropped. And it's further reinforced by the fact that so many of them are caught on camera from steady, stabilized tripod mounted cameras that are pointing at exactly where the bomb's going to fall. How did they manage to catch that? It's because they knew the bomb was coming, because Israel had warned them. So once again, we just see all these drip feeds of evidence which build a picture of what actually happened in Gaza. And it's very different to that portrayed in the international media.
And to stack upon Israel being such poor shots, I mean, they really, really suck at genocide too, considering that the population of Gaza has actually, what people don't understand, increased since October 7th, 2023. So for all the incrimination of the IDF as being these genocidal baby killers, I mean, it sounds like they might need some new training.
Yeah, and it's important to address that as well, because a common misconception or a common false rebuttal to this is that it comes from a a CIA World Factbook estimate from before the war. And that's just not true, because not only have Save the Children reported on how many people were pregnant, but the UN Population Fund have reported a birth rate of about 5,500 a month since the war started. That's, they've reported that, not predicted it. And then in the last week, we've actually seen Palestinians on social media cheering for how many babies have been born in the last 15 months. So multiple sources confirm this, that more babies, 68,000, have been born in Gaza compared to the 45 plus 10,000 missing that that Hamas are reporting.
Wow. So in light of the fact that either Israel's really bad at war, or perhaps that no matter what unprecedented length Israel goes to in order to mitigate civilian casualties and suffering in Gaza, they still fall victim to the most relentless and unfounded condemnation from every corner of the globe. I hate but have to ask, is military morality a losing strategy?
It's a really tricky one. I think to start with, trying to put your troops into a situation where they have to act immorally to achieve their mission is going to be damaging in the long run. We list maintenance of morale as a principle of war for a very good reason. And soldiers without morale and with moral injury won't fight as well. And, you know, I genuinely think a lot of soldiers refuse to pull the trigger if you ask them to start dropping civilians left, right and center. The bigger question is, how do we get around the condemnation for acting morally? You evacuate civilians, you're accused of ethnic cleansing. You know, that's really, really tricky. You put them in humanitarian zones, the enemy hide there, you strike the enemy, you get accused of attacking safe zones, which nobody has ever called Al-Mawasi in Gaza. It's never called it a safe zone. The Israelis have always said it's at best a safer zone or a humanitarian zone. So that's an important point of clarification. But no, I think we have to look at how the narrative has been controlled by Hamas during this war, look at the tactics they've used to exploit people's emotion and hijack their empathy with pictures of destroyed buildings and dead children. And we have to find a better way to make the case for going to war, so that when America or the United Kingdom go to war, then we don't face this kind of onslaught. Because we've seen what happened to Israel, and we're ready to counter a similar attempt against us.
Yeah, and so you have actually spoken a number of times about Hamas's like weaponization of emotions, really, by flooding both the mass media and social media with these heart-wrenching images. Like, it doesn't matter if you are Netanyahu, the most pro-Israel person on earth, can't look at these images and have their heart break. I mean, it's just these images of the destruction in Gaza. And then Israel, on the other hand, is fighting this information war with facts and figures. Now, of course, you are correct when you say that Israel can't win the information war by trying to counter emotions with rationality, and that on some level they're gonna have to fight fire with fire. But like, how could Israel possibly leverage the emotional element in this current context? I mean, murdered Jewish babies were so 2023, and according to like the Warp Speed like news cycle, they're like tragically considered completely irrelevant to today's conversation. I mean, just look at the conversation on social media when anybody tries to bring up Kfir or Ariel, and how many people still like are just like, and so that justifies 45, like they don't even matter. Not to mention the extreme denial out there that the atrocities of 10/7 ever even occurred in the first place. So let's be honest, all we have really, if we wanted to use visuals, would be like IDF casualties and injuries. And in the face of a family under the rubble of Gaza, the general public does not care about IDF casualties. In fact, I'm sure like a lot of them actually celebrated them. So like, thanks to Israel's incomparable defense systems, there aren't any bombed babies to parade around. So honestly, how can Israel possibly win this war of sensationalism, of images and emotions?
Well, I think the one thing that they could have done that they didn't, for good reason, was make more of October the 7th, if that makes sense. I think a lot of people out there don't really understand what actually happened on 7th of October, because the footage is so limited as to what you can actually see or find. There's very, very few sources you can go to actually see the videos of what happened on 7th of October. Now, they've shown it to journalists, the 47-minute piece. They've shown it to people like me, veterans groups that have gone out there. And of course, having walked the ground in places like Be'eri and Nahal Oz, you know, seeing that room in the military base where people were locked inside and burned to death, I mean, it kind of gives you an understanding of what happens on 7th of October that I think most people don't have. And I think we also have to consider that around the world, people don't care enough to really go into this in detail. You know, 10% of people really, really care about the Israeli side. 10% really, really care about the Palestinian side. The other 80% of people are just trying to pay their mortgage and collect the kids from school and get on with their lives. And they don't sit there obsessing over what happens in Israel because they've got no connection. And it's just another war in the Middle East that's where bad stuff's happening. And how many of those have we seen in the last 20 years? It's not particularly new or exciting. And I think as a result of the information that's been held back by Israel about 7th of October, as a result of the world's population not really caring, you know, because it's just another Middle Eastern war, I think it's very easy when people start to form opinions just from seeing headlines. So, you know, Israel strikes school in Gaza, like a BBC headline, for example. You know, what's your immediate reaction going to be if you don't care much and you don't know much about the conflict? It's going to be, oh my God, they bombed a school. All those poor children, how awful. Okay, and you know, if anyone's expert or interested, the 10% who are, you know, in favor of Israel's action are going to say, okay, we know the school year in Gaza ended in November 2023 and hasn't resumed. We know that Hamas is using schools for headquarters and locations like that. You know, calling this a school is actually disingenuous because there's no education of children happening in there. It's a building that's being used. When you have all that context, all of a sudden Israel strikes Hamas commander who have commandeered a building is a very different headline. But the 80% who don't pay attention won't realize that. And they'll come to the conclusion that Israel is bombing school kids while they're trying to do finger painting. So this is the kind of the disingenuous narrative and disingenuous way the media has played it. How do you counter that? Well, it's very tricky. And, you know, I think, you know, showing more of 7th of October was probably an answer, but out of respect for the victims, I can see why they didn't do that, which really presents us with an almost impossible dilemma, I would suggest.
The fact that social media is so deeply stacked against Israel does not help either. I mean, as somebody who does look at, there are many people who are still posting about the hostages and about the victims of 10/7 every single day. And you can see the engagement tapering off. You know, the people, what makes me sad is the pro-Israel community, I think, is getting sort of like bored with the whole thing. Like, oh, okay, whatever. And even as the other side is ratcheting up their attacks. But I want to ask one more like sort of specific question about your report before going on to next topic. Because being like highly involved in like all the WhatsApp groups and all the different pages and whatever, I could tell you that I have not seen like such an explosion of respect for any single person in this entire war then came out for you across all platforms after this groundbreaking report. So while like you are upheld, I from talking to you the past few months, I get the sense you don't fully grasp like how much of a hero you are for Israel and the entire pro-Israel world. And I do want to make sure to like really emphasize that point in public. But at the same time, you got only a fraction of the attention in the mass media, which is, as you said, so shamefully and irresponsibly propagated the propaganda and lies of Hamas as if They were gospel. So on one hand, it's hard for people to retract statistics that they have banked their whole viability on, right? If they go for 12 months saying, by the way, you know, Israel is killing all women and children, and then they're like, oh, never mind. It turns out we were wrong. Like, so these are the kinds of retractions that wind up on like page 27 of like section D of a paper. But your report honestly is so very integral to understanding the war, and particularly when like serious consequences in like the UN, the ICC, the ICJ, like may very well ride on your findings. So can you tell us what kind of reception your report has gotten within these international bodies?
Well, the international media has been really good, to be fair. We've had over 20 countries where people have covered it in mainstream media. I did over 30 interviews in the run-up to the publication, and we had a social media reach that we could measure of well over 200 million impressions across every platform. So the word got out, which is what we wanted. And the idea was that we would give people ammunition to have in their back pocket. You know, we always knew how the reception would go. People who wanted to read it would go, amazing, that's awesome. People who didn't want to read it would go, that's a load of nonsense. And a lot of people just would be like, yeah, boring. What was the sports results yesterday? You know, so we knew how the reception would go. We knew we weren't going to change any minds particularly, because as you say, no multinational media is going to row back and say, actually, we've been reporting nonsense for the last 15 months. They're just not going to do it. And so when it comes to policymakers, we have got meetings lined up with policymakers. I can't talk too much about that, but they're pretty high profile. And we'll see how those go. But hopefully when it does come to the trial, the lawyers and the people who have access to the Palestinian Population Registry, which will be a huge deal, hopefully they'll be able to build on our work and make a convincing legal case.
Yeah. Okay, let me pivot now to the ceasefire deal. Okay, so let's start. So as an expert in the field, you've been very objective, honestly, in your analyses, and have at times expressed like really direct criticism of Israel's execution of the war. I find you extremely unbiased and in objective in your findings and in across reports and interviews. I'm confused because a couple weeks ago, you argued that Israel has accomplished everything it can in its military campaign in Gaza, and that withdrawal of its forces was perhaps long overdue. Your suggestion was that ending combat operations, not to put words back into your mouth about what you're saying,
yeah, of course,
would give Israel a stronger hand in negotiations. And I was hoping you could explain the logic behind that strategy, which I know you said you share with former Israel Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant. So I'm not questioning its veracity. I am just trying to clarify the logic.
Yeah, well, we can all say that General Hindsight is the best general of all time, and he's never lost a battle. So I'm very wary of being that guy. The way to look at this and analyze it properly is to look at strategic goals that Israel had at the start of the war. And the first one was securing Israel's borders. The second one was dismantling Hamas. And the third one was recovering the hostages. And we have to weigh up everything that's happened on the ground within the bounds of the possible, and then work out to what extent they've been achieved or not. So can we say that Israel's borders are a lot more secure than they were on 7th or 8th of October 2023? Then yes, we can, I think. We can point to the buffer zone that Israel has established. We can point to the extent to which they've degraded Hamas's strategic capabilities, mainly their expeditionary fighters, if you will, the Nakba forces, who are the ones who are essentially special forces for Hamas, who conducted the raid on 7th of October. They're shattered. Their capabilities are destroyed. The tunnels are heavily damaged. You know, hardly any rockets are able to launch into Israel now. And when we look at defeat in military terms, we talk about degrading the enemy to between 50 and 69% of capability. So by any sort of metric of a conventional army, Hamas are defeated militarily. And Israel's border is a lot more secure. Now, we talk about what about Hamas governance, but I would argue that without a full regime change operation like we saw in Baghdad or in Kabul, that's just not going to happen. How do you winkle an administrative structure out if you don't provide something else to replace it and then protect that something else so that the insurgents can't overthrow them again, like the Taliban did in 2021? And I think that would have been a foolish thing for Israel to do because those campaigns don't work. We've got plenty of evidence from the last 20 plus years to say that trying to do a counterinsurgency regime change type operation is not something that has been effective without a huge occupation. And that would take up the whole IDF. It would take up 300,000 people permanently in Gaza securing the streets. And that's just not something I think Israel wants to get involved with. So when we look at the strategic goals, the military ones have been pretty much achieved, and they were achieved at the end of the Rafah operation, and nothing hugely has changed. I mean, there's a lot more dead goons between now and July, but dead goons don't necessarily achieve strategic goals, whilst being a good thing, broadly speaking, to have fewer Hamas around. We're not really achieving a great deal beyond what we've already achieved, if we think of it in those terms. So I would have personally, I'd have withdrawn after the Rafah op in sort of July time, and then Israel could have negotiated for the hostage return from a position saying that, right, we're coming back in if you don't negotiate with us. It would have allowed them to say that Hamas didn't win. You know, a really popular narrative in Arab media and social media is that Israel were forced out by the brave Hamas, freedom fighters, and it's a huge win for them. In the Arab world, because they didn't get destroyed to the last man. A voluntary withdrawal potentially could have avoided all that. But when we talk about using the military to recover the hostages, I think if you haven't done that in 15 months, it's going to be very difficult to do it in month 16 onwards, because we know Hamas are keeping the hostages close. We know they're keeping them and ready to kill them should the IDF get close to rescuing them. We saw what happened with Hirsch, Goldberg, Poland, and the other five. And the last thing we want is that to be repeated again. So from that perspective, I don't think military force would do a great deal more in terms of that goal of recovering the hostages. And it would have to be a negotiation and Israel having to swallow compromises that perhaps aren't that palatable, but maybe would have been more palatable were their troops already withdrawn from Gaza.
So my first reaction is, what is there left to negotiate if you withdraw? Like, if there's no if you withdraw and you stop any sort of bombing or attack, then what pressure would they possibly have to negotiate for the lives of the hostages, first of all? But the other thing that I want to say, because this is something I've really struggled with a lot, is that. So right now, the pro-Hamas team is celebrating their bragging rights, whether they're true or whether they're not. So I guess that deep down inside, because it does hurt to watch that, is like, is this about saving face or is this about saving a nation?
I mean, it depends which nation you're talking about.
Israel.
I mean, is it about saving, have we saved Israel through the hostage deal? I mean, I think you could talk about the wounds that the hostages have inflicted, you know, the taking of hostages have inflicted on Israeli society. At least, you know, if this phase one comes good, then there's huge progress towards healing and getting these people free and back to their families. I don't think the Gaza campaign had a huge impact on Israel's long-term existence as a country. The Lebanon campaign did, absolutely 100%. The Iran attacks did, 100%. Gaza has been more of a tactical sideshow than a strategic problem for Israel over the last 15 months. You know, this is not a conflict that has been existential in Gaza, whereas having your whole north of the country displaced because of Hezbollah rockets is absolutely existential. And to say it's not, I think, is deeply disingenuous. And so in terms of saving a nation, I mean, the ceasefire deal, I don't think, does that. But what it does do is hopefully save the hostages, which is clearly vitally important.
Okay, so So let me ask this, as far as withdrawal is concerned, what bargaining chips do we have left if we vacate Gaza? I mean, we like even just like the control of the Netzarim corridor and 1 million Gazans flooding back to northern Gaza is going to be like a real, I think, tactical challenge for restarting the war should it come to that. And it most likely will. Hamas has never upheld a ceasefire agreement ever. I mean, there is a chance this will be the first because of A, the Trump effect, and B, it's actually in their favor to, hello, to do so. But it just seems that when we give up territorial leverage, we give up leverage. And obviously, you know this a lot better than my simplistic view of war, but boy, without Israeli presence in there, it just seems like the hostages will be left to languish at best or just be slaughtered at worst.
Well, you've got to ask what the opposite was achieving. There was no ceasefire forthcoming after 15 months until Mr. Trump essentially ordered the
Right.
Prime Minister of Israel to cease fire and ordered Hamas to cease fire. And that was what made the difference. It wasn't Israel's military presence in Gaza. It wasn't the IDF's ongoing operations killing thousands of Hamas fighters. It was just because Trump said stop. So either way, it's not particularly an effective negotiating or bargaining technique, and that's why Israel's had to give up so much in the hostage deal. Releasing thousands of convicted criminals to regain a few hostages, and it's a deeply one-sided deal in favor of Hamas. And you have to make the case, I think, that that was always going to be the case if military operations didn't recover the hostages in very, very quick order after October 2023.
Yeah. I mean, historically speaking, the world simply won't let Israel actually win a war. Hard stop. I mean, any minute of any day since October 7th, the President of the United States and other world leaders could have just applied like spine-crushing pressure on Hamas and its benefactors to release the hostages, put down their arms, and surrender the war. Instead, we got the ceasefire deal that we got. I mean, however deeply flawed, if all three stages are carried out to fruition, at least we would like have the miracle of seeing all the hostages released home. Still, as you said, I mean, basically every term of this agreement is little more than a grand concession to terror. And while it would be hard to dispute that Trump is the single most pro-Israel president in history, even he, and perhaps despite his extraordinarily pro-Israel cabinet, he ultimately forced this ceasefire, as you said, down Netanyahu's throat, thereby ensuring that once again, Israel would not win this war. So, do you really think that this is the best deal that Israel could have hoped for, given the crushing blow it dealt to Hamas and Gaza? And you believe they would have gotten a better deal had they withdrawn months ago and tried to negotiate from that point?
No, it's a good question. And, the benefits of withdrawing months ago would be a lot more alive IDF soldiers, I think, and probably Gazan civilians as well. Because obviously some would have died in the months between Rafah and now. That would have been the advantage. I don't think the deal would have looked a huge amount different had they withdrawn. And we don't know what would have happened in the interim either. The Trump thing, I think, is fascinating. I don't know what carrot he offered to go with the stick, or whether it's just pure stick. I've seen reports to say it was simply that. And of course, Bibi and Trump go back a while in terms of grudge, because Bibi endorsed Biden when he won the election. So there's obviously a bit of score settling from President Trump as well. So it's, there's so many complexities into this. I mean, we haven't even touched on the role of Qatar yet, and the fact that Hamas's prime benefactor were the ones who were allegedly mutually negotiating a ceasefire deal, which is absolutely beyond parody. How we allowed Qatar to play such a big role in this. It was really, really poor planning on the West part that we would set them up as negotiators. And I suspect it's very indicative of how much money Qatar has pumped into certain political echelons in the West as well. We know that Steve Witkoff, Trump's envoy, is heavily in hock to the Qataris. He's praised them endlessly for their efforts, at the same time as Qatari state media is pumping out rabidly anti-Israel stuff to the Arab world, whilst putting on a happy face in English. So huge numbers of factors here. So I would never dream of definitively saying that Israel should have done X, Y, Z and things would have turned out better. My case would be that by pulling out early, they'd probably have a very similar looking deal, but there would have been peace for a lot longer and fewer IDF soldiers would have fallen and fewer innocents would have been harmed.
Okay. No good
outcomes to this, unfortunately, I think is the bottom line I'm making.
There is no good outcomes, and there's never going to be a good outcome if we continue to negotiate with terrorists, and not only to continue to negotiate with them, but to validate them as if they are like an equal partner, not only an equal partner, but to cede to them in light of this horrific pogrom that happened on 10/7 for them to win this war, so to speak. And I know there's no real winner in this war, but it is an utter disgrace. But I think that from a humanistic point of view, ultimately, we all just want to see the hostages home. I think all good people in the world just want to see all 94 remaining hostages. I mean, we know that many of them, unfortunately, are deceased, but we at least want to see them home. And this past Sunday, we all forgot about the terrible deal, at least for a moment, and we're able to celebrate the pure joy of seeing Doron, Emily, and Romy return home. And tomorrow we will, God willing, welcome four more female hostages home. But I'm curious, you're in London. In light of the unbridled anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism that we've seen in London and the weekly marches for terror, what was the broad national reaction in the UK to the ceasefire and the release of Emily Damari, who happens to be one of your nation's own citizens? I'm going to go on a limb and assume that the jihadis did not flood the streets by the hundreds of thousands to call for peace from the river to the sea.
No, they did come out on Saturday, about 5,000 of them, and they had 77 arrests for breaching conditions because they were told they weren't allowed to set up near a synagogue, but they were insistent that they had the right to do that, and they had a falling out with the Metropolitan Police as a result, and a lot of their leaders are now getting charged for breaching those conditions, which I think I pointed out on X is quite the contrast to the March Against Anti-Semitism, which had zero arrests. Draw into that what you will. But there were only 5,000 of them. They were static in Whitehall and they didn't really achieve anything apart from make themselves look like absolute fools and get arrested. So that went pretty well. In terms of the media, actually, they've been pretty good, especially with Emily, because she is, as you say, British. I've met her mother a couple of times and she's been an absolute warrior and an inspiration for the last 15 months. So I was especially delighted for Mandy to see that Emily came out safe. And I think we're all pretty chuffed of Emily and how sparky she was in those initial photos and how she sort of owned the injury that Hamas had inflicted on her and wouldn't let it define her, which I think is really rather wonderful and speaks to her character. So that was all rather fantastic.
Sure, absolutely. Now, a lot of people are saying that perhaps like this deal at face value is so bad because there are some secret back-end guarantees, particularly vis-a-vis Iran. I can't help but think, or maybe just hope, that this ceasefire would never have been agreed to by Netanyahu, who's been so good about standing up to international pressure, including from President Biden, if this were taken at face value. So it seems like perhaps like there's some sort of implicit support. And I know that in the last couple of days, this might have been debunked. For Israel's mission to destroy the Iranian nuclear infrastructure and take down the Ayatollah's regime once and for all. Now, Trump is talking more and more about like preventing wars before they even happen. after pulling out of the JCPOA, for him to think that there is actually like a diplomatic solution to dealing with the Ayatollah. I'm not going to go there. But so if in fact the plan is to just walk away from Hamas and instead like cut off the head of the snake, what would be the downstream effects of such a broad military campaign against Iran? And do you think that Israel once again would be expected to do the world's dirty work? Or do you think that the U.S. might actually provide more than just material support?
I mean, I think if Iran are caught out making a deliberate drive for a deliverable nuclear warhead, then I would be very surprised if the United States and other countries as well actually didn't weigh in. The issue is it's much more difficult to do than to say, because these nuclear facilities are buried, they're hidden away, there's a lot of them. And the program is also sufficiently advanced that you'd need to pretty much take out all of them at the same time to make sure that Iran didn't make a very quick rush to finish the bomb in the sites that you'd missed or hadn't hit yet. So it would need a very nuanced and careful bit of planning at scale that I'm not sure Israel has the fighter jets to carry off, to be honest. I think you'd need those American B-52s to start rocking and rolling to make sure that the job was done properly. So the worst case scenario is that Israel would try it alone and not complete the job, and then Iran rushes and makes the bomb anyway. That would be a very poor outcome that I think the world would really be keen to avoid. And so should there be a trigger to launch an operation like that, I think multinational is probably more likely. The issue of regime change is quite thorny as well, because we've got a lot of examples of regime change in the Middle East over the last 20 plus years, and they haven't gone particularly well. If we look at Iraq, what followed Saddam was worse. If we look at Syria, what followed Assad is potentially worse. If we look at Libya, what followed was absolutely worse in terms of pure anarchy and ISIS owning half the country, destabilizing the entire Maghreb region. So we have to be very careful with regime change as to what comes next. And we've got two failed Western efforts to get involved in Iran to look back on over the 20th century and say that potentially what followed the people that were deposed was far worse. Mm-hmm. How do we stop what follows on in Iran from being worse? It's really difficult because Iran has 500,000 men in the field in their armed forces. They're not particularly good, but it's certainly enough to pacify Tehran and certainly enough to keep either a succession government to the Ayatollah's regime in place, or to replace it with a military dictatorship or something similar to that. So there are a lot of variables in all of this, and there's no simple or easy answers. It's a very nuanced situation.
What do you think about the strategy of empowering and encouraging the actual citizens of Iran to uprise and overthrow the government?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to do it, including subverting those 500,000 men in arms. Making sure that should the citizenry rise up, they don't get slaughtered. I mean, I think that is a realistic possibility. And the last thing we want to do is encourage Iranians to step up and revolt and then not give them any support and see them all get massacred. That could go, horrendously wrong if we don't do that properly. So, but again, how do you inspire a nation to rise up? What incentives can you give them? What guarantees, what support? I mean, this is really, really tricky, deep stuff that needs a lot of thinking before we even talk about attempting it.
Yeah, in the scenario of a public uprising, I mean, we have to understand that the citizens become de facto soldiers. And as we've seen, like in the Arab Spring / winter, that these are people who are willing to die for their ideals. And but I mean, there seems to be quite a groundswell if you follow like social media of Iranian people, of Iranians who do want to overthrow the government, who actually support Israel and, want to be saved. So I think there are a lot of people putting a lot of faith in the Iranian people and their at least desire to unshackle themselves from the regime.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the desire is clearly there, but what isn't there is the tanks and the anti-tank rounds and the fighter jets to take on the regime's forces. So that would be my concern. And that's why I'm saying that should we decide that we're going to encourage this as the West, we need to give serious thought as to how we properly support them and how we subvert those half a million soldiers so that they don't fight for the regime, and they either just lay down their weapons or they change sides.
Sure. Okay. So beyond Iran, so secret agent Shauna is wondering, as other people are, like, maybe Israel has another surprise, like the Beeper attacks. I mean, some things have crossed my mind. They're sending almost 2,000 terrorists back home in just this first phase alone. Like, maybe there's a goodie bag or microchips, ingestible explosives, or maybe most likely, what about like informants or double agents? Like, what are the chances that there will be one or more informants like Mossab Hassan Youssef that come out of this prisoner exchange? Like, there are a lot of possibilities. And if there's one thing that Israel has proven to the world, particularly in the last 6 months, is how innovative their tactics are to a mind-boggling extent.
Yeah, but you know, if I knew what they were, then I wouldn't be able to tell you anyway, or I'd have Mossad after me. So we can only speculate that something like that has happened. What I can tell you is, in conversations with senior Israeli commanders, they've said that the war has been a revelation in terms of human intelligence, i.e. covert sources from Gazans on the ground giving information to the IDF. So Israel's been heavily electronic focused, so signals intelligence, electronic intelligence, overflights using drones for kind of imagery intelligence. But actually, a lot of that has taken the back foot in favor of Gazan civilians giving them the information they need to prosecute targets. And my biggest hope after the war is that that can be continued as the IDF withdraw. They keep getting that inside line from people on the ground who can make sure that should any of the really malign Hamas actors pop up, then perhaps Israel can do something about it, either with a direct strike or with a slightly more sneaky method, as you alluded to.
But in light of the informants, I mean, keep in mind, not a single Gazan has stepped forward with rewards between $1 million to $5 million to actually help us get back a hostage. So I don't know how, certainly there's a lot of information, but the question is like to what extent people are really able and willing. I mean, even in the last week, we've seen Hamas killing dozens of so-called assumed, and I believe Hezbollah did it too, Israeli informants. And this becomes a very dangerous game. I don't know how Mossad like pulled it off. I mean, nobody does. But it would be amazing if after, you know, some of these hardened terrorists have been in Israeli jails for decades, that perhaps there are some people who might be able to help us. Now, I just on a very serious note, I mean, because I know that, I mean, obviously it's fun to think about the possibilities. I mean, nobody could have thought about the Beeper thing. But I want to talk very briefly about IDF Chief Herzi Alevi. You know, just this week he accepted, I mean, he actually did this after 10/7, but this week he very publicly accepted personal responsibility for the failures of 10/7 and announced his formal resignation after 40 years of service to his country. Personally, I believe he accomplished quite incredible things in the execution of the Seven Front War. And to be honest, it crushed my heart when he said that he's been living with this unbearable shame since October 7th and will until the day he dies. I mean, that's a burden that is impossible to imagine anybody carrying to his or her grave. It's also one of the most understated repercussions of this war, the traumatic scars that will wound an entire nation for perhaps generations to come. Now, you've been very open and outspoken about the crippling realities of PTSD, yours more specifically having to do with combat, but war is a very multifaceted traumatic event. So how do you think Israel, who's been so deeply traumatized from the most powerful leaders to the tiniest baby, will emerge back into life in the wake of this war?
I mean, the person you really need to ask about that is Dr. Aurélie Peter. She's a psych a neuropsychologist in LA who's been doing a lot of work on PTSD with Israelis after, you know, since the war started. And she's been doing some utterly incredible work with Israelis, particularly Nova survivors who have been, you know, obviously devastated by what they had to go through. And my hope is that the IDF, I think they take this stuff seriously. I've not seen any indication that they don't. I've visited rehab centers for wounded IDF soldiers in Israel, and they seem very well cared and looked after. And it's the ones who don't end up getting the treatment that will be in real trouble. We have to be slightly careful, I think, about catastrophizing about PTSD and things like that, because some people won't be affected at all. Others will be deeply affected, and that's not a judgment on their characters. It's simply that some people would have been through different things to others, and it'll affect them in different ways. And there's no kind of hard and fast rule for how you end up with PTSD. And to give you an example from my own experience, the single worst thing I've ever seen in my life does not bother me remotely. That doesn't bother me at all. I won't tell you what it was because it's truly awful, but it was, you know, I don't lose a wink of sleep over it. I do, however, lose a lot of sleep over a casualty who bled out when I was there trying to help. And it's the fact I felt responsible for the soldier that died. He was an Afghan soldier. It's that responsibility and the burden of that really affected me. The really terrible thing was stuff we did. We were in total control. It was a bad guy trying to kill us, and he died unpleasantly. And doesn't bother me. So it's when we're looking at sort of PTSD after this war, you know, it's those kind of really niche things, and it's going to be a different trigger for every single different person. And each person that comes forward and asks for help needs to be treated in a slightly different way. So it's really complex again and tricky. But people like Orly have set up the Israel Healing Initiative, where she's taking the latest high-tech equipment out to Israel, and they're doing whatever they can to help. And it's people like Orly that are going to make the difference when it comes to helping people recover and heal from the last 15 months.
Sounds like I need to get her on the show.
Oh, you should. She's awesome. I love her.
I'll reach out. Thank you for that suggestion.
I'll connect you if you want. It's great.
That would be amazing. So we just crossed the 1 hour mark. As always, I have 100 more questions, but why don't we start to wrap this up in respect for your valuable time?
Thank you.
So let us mention once again that last week, the Algeminer designated you as one of the J100, one of the top 100 people positively influencing Jewish life in 2024. Did you ever imagine in your capacity as an urban warfare expert that you would one day become one of the most important voices supporting the Jewish world? I'm sure that fighting anti-Semitism was never a part of your original war plan.
No, it wasn't, if I'm honest. And it's humbling, and it's moving that anything I've done has made a difference. And if that's the case, then I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to have done so. Looking at yourself on a list alongside Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu and Javier Milei is quite surreal, if I'm brutally honest. I did have my buddy John Spencer right next to me, so
you were like list. 24 and 25. I mean, you were way up there.
I know, absolutely bonkers. So you know, I've always said that whilst doing war analysis has been really important, standing up for the UK, particularly its Jewish community, has been far more important than that to me, because my countrymen and women don't deserve to live in fear just because of their ethnicity or religion, be that Jewish or Muslim. But it's the Jewish community who are in the firing line at the moment and getting the most abuse. So I took a particularly vocal line on that. And as I said, I wrote on my Substack that I'm honored to have made a difference if I have at all. But it kind of disgusts me that it was ever necessary. And, you know, this can't go on. And I hope more people speak out and try and make a difference to this really poisonous narrative that's running through society at the moment.
You've been so inspiring to so many people. So please do not question whether you have made a difference or not. Can I ask you, did you have any like understanding or awareness of anti-Zionism and or anti-Semitism before this war, or not even just before this war, before sort of getting involved with Israel?
No, not really. I mean, the UK Jewish community is tiny, really tiny. I think it's 120,000. It's minuscule. And they tend to sort of live in certain areas like North London, where I've never been particularly before. I'm a country boy. I'm from sort of the British equivalent of Indiana, if that makes sense to your kind of viewers. It's never been a big part of my life. It's never been something that really flicked onto my radar. But after 7th of October and those celebrations in London, you know, I did have a couple of Jewish friends. I saw how it really affected them. And really, that's what sort of fired me up to speak out. I was lucky enough to have a platform on X or Twitter or whatever it was at the time. And I thought it was, you know, a duty on me to speak out and say something, because I had a voice where maybe others didn't.
Did you have any concept of how much backlash that was going to cause for you?
No, it didn't. I never thought that it might generate quite the entertaining levels of relentless abuse that it does. But, you know, it's funny to, it just shows you the stupidity of these people. That's all they've got is insults. And I've had probably every anti-Semitic insult you've ever heard thrown at me, so I know what it's like. Even though I'm not Jewish, it's, you know, you get accused of certain things enough times and it becomes a bit, you know, a bit grinding. So, and it's not even true that I'm Jewish. So they're accusing me of something that is completely false. I can only imagine how much it would hurt if I were actually Jewish and we're taking those slurs on a daily basis. So yeah, that's kind of my motivation. And the more they abuse me, the more I push back. So that's kind of how I'm
Because
built.
I think that, like you and John, aren't fully aware that this is not new. As somebody who's been on this, like, this social media fight since the advent of social media, even as a woman, even as a yoga instructor, even in the world of love and light, the amount of the horrific abuse that I have been on the receiving end of for the last, particularly since 2014, that was like an interesting confluence of another war in Gaza, or conflict, depending on how you look at the terminology. And that was when social media started dominating the world narrative of actual, you know, thought patterns. It's been remarkable. I do think you would have, you seem someone of very, very, very high moral values. Do you think you would have jumped in knowing what you know now about what the backlash would be? Because you could have just as easily limited your involvement to just analyzing the war. You did not have to speak up so vocally. And let me, for anybody who doesn't know, Andrew did not only, let's say, defend Israel on a lot of fronts based on, again, very objective analyses, but he has spoken at huge anti-Semitism rallies and events. Like, he has gone full on into this, you know, war on anti-Semitism, and that was a choice. Would you have made the same choice if you knew like what the backlash would have been?
Yeah, of course I would. Yeah. Easy answer. Easy answer.
Okay. This may or may not be an easy answer. Do you think the barbaric response to 10/7 is an anti-Semitism problem or a Western civilization problem? Or maybe something?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think it's both. I don't think everything is anti-Semitism. You know, I think my statistic from earlier about 10% really caring either side, 80% not really bothering and just being heavily influenced by really negative reporting. And also, I think there is a societal problem in terms of actually mental health in some ways. I've seen a fascinating study out of Canada talking about how they did a study on pro-Palestinian protesters and found really high levels of anxiety. There's some really interesting psychological stuff out there. I think a lot of the time when people are campaigning for Palestine, they're not really campaigning for Palestine at all. They're campaigning against something. And it's the very act of being against something is what they're interested in, because it creates a sense of belonging to a movement. It creates an other to hate. And these are really powerful motivators that we've seen throughout history in various forms. And so, yeah, the pro-Palestine movement, half of them, I bet, couldn't even point it out on a map.
Right.
You know, guarantee. So they're operating in a sea of disinformation. They're operating on a heavily activated emotional system because they've been fired up by appalling photographs and videos, and they're running on, you know, an anti-establishment platform almost. So it's a really tricky problem to unpack. But of course, anti-Semitism plays a huge role in that, particularly in certain corners of the internet.
Yeah. Okay, I have to ask one last question, because I gotta make you blush hard enough that we can
see it. I match my top. Yeah.
that's the goal. Andrew Fox, how does it feel to be a hero? You gotta answer it.
I wouldn't know, in all honesty. No, I don't think there's anything especially heroic about what I've done. I think it's simply a matter of doing the right thing, trying to make sure that you do what's right when the moment calls, because we've got examples from history that show us what happens when people don't do what's right. And I would never want to be in that camp when it comes to supporting our Jewish communities. So that's why I do it.
FYI, that is what makes you a hero. You're pinkish, maybe not
ish. I don't blush particularly easy, but the fact I'm shy is it tells you all you need to know.
Well deserved. Andrew, I just want to thank you again for joining me a second time for a most enlightening conversation. I look forward to hearing more and more from you in the future as you go down in history as one of the most important documentarians and historians of this moment. So thank you for everything that you do.
You're too kind, but thank you very much.